with Robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics. Hello and welcome to the 82nd episode of Robots. I'm Jana, and today we will be exploring the dangerous world of demining and diffusing robotics. But first, as always, here's the news with Christine.
It's not often that researchers invent new forms of robot locomotion, but this week's news features two such cases. Researchers at the Biomechatronics Lab at Choi University in Japan have created a modular robot that can move using an unusual technique called galloping, gleaned from the movement of some snails. Unlike the more well-known undulating snail motion, galloping involves the snail sticking out its front to a surface and then drawing up the rest of its body behind it. Each module of the Toro 2 robot has a large grippy area for ground contact. A video shows 8 of the modules connected in a circle, allowing the robot to move in any direction. In addition to this circular configuration, the robot can also quickly contract into a longitudinal shape with 2 parallel chains of modules. This allows it to move faster in a single direction. The researchers believe that its greater resilience to things like unintended shoves may give Toro 2 some advantages over other methods of omnidirectional movement, such as omni-wheels. The second new method of locomotion comes from a grad student at Bradley University in Illinois and goes by the name of Hemispherical Omnidirectional Gimbaled Wheel, or HOG HOG. It is also called a singularity drive system. A first prototype consists of a small brushless motor attached to a rubber hemisphere pointing downwards and acting as a robot wheel, and 2 actuators to tilt the motor. When the motor is turned on and pointing straight downwards, it exerts a small rotational force allowing the robot to spin on the spot. However, tilting the motor sideways will put the spinning side in contact with the ground and accelerate the robot forward. By varying the amount of tilt, the robot can regulate its speed. Tilting the motor to the opposite side reverses the robot's direction. A video with a single fast-spinning hemisphere below a robot shows how the robot can perform very aggressive drive maneuvers with near instantaneous changes in direction and orientation. A second version, with 2 rotating hemispheres as wheels, allows for even more maneuverability, including strafing. That's it for this episode's news. For more information and to have a look at the videos, have a look at www.robotspodcast.com.
The Swiss organization DigaDTR is a not-for-profit foundation that provides technical assistance for humanitarian demining. For 13 years, the organization has been specializing in the design of mine clearance assistance tools, which have already been used in countries such as Croatia, Bosnia-Herzegovina, and Sudan. Our reporter Amanda met Frederick Gern, the director of DigaDTR, at the EPFL Robotics Fair in Lausanne, Switzerland.
Hello, Frederick, and welcome to Robots.
Hello, Amanda.
Thanks for being with us. So at this robotics festival, you definitely have the most impressive robot here. It's the largest. It's called the Digger, am I correct?
It's a Digger D2, yes. It's a second generation of our machine, exactly.
Okay. So why don't you start by presenting your company to our listeners?
Our company is it's a kind of special mix. It's a humanitarian company. We work in a humanitarian world, demining world, anti-personnel mine. That's our aim. And together we are a production organization. That means we develop and produce machine and sell machine also. That's a kind of mix between commercial and non-profit work.
Right, I see. So what you are a non-profit organization. What exactly does that mean for you?
Ooh, that means a lot of things. First, the aim of our work. That means our aim is to try to save lives. That means our machine has no interest if they don't work and don't save lives by destroying landmines. On the other side, being a non-profit organization has a lot of influence because we cannot call to investor. And that means for the financial point, we don't have a lot of finance. That's always the main problem. And we live through the donors, for example. And a company living through donors, it's quite special and quite difficult to go further. But that means also the aim of our company is ensured that to in that way.
You have a very consistent aim indeed.
Yes, that's very important.
But I assume this is a market which is not only dominated by your company. There are other companies in this market. I assume also commercial companies. What is the difference between what you're selling, your product, and how you function with those other commercial companies?
Yes, it exists four other main other companies building machine like ours. And, well, the contacts are not bad, but that's competitor also. I think it's not a bad thing because we have competition between us. That means we must build the best machine, also the price. We have to be careful to the price. That's not a bad thing. The philosophy of the other company is totally commercial. That's the main difference between them and us. And, okay, sometimes we see special things in the field, but it works. That's just a difference of mentality.
Right. Maybe you could describe to us how a typical mission works. So from the moment that the machine leaves your factory until the demining has been completed.
Okay. A demining machine like us is not a very high technology machine. It's a basic work that is done through this machine. That means a machine like our digs, and its aim is to dig the earth and to destroy mines. There is no detection, no high technology things. So second point is the machine is remote controlled. That means you have an operator, remote operator for his safety at 50 to 100 meters, and he drives the machine in the field and do his job in a secure way of working. And, okay, that's not so complicated, it's easy, but you have all the logistics because the machine is, say, a 10-ton machine. You have to drive it to the field. You need infrastructure. You have to make the service to the machine. And, okay, that's mechanical, mainly mechanical work.
I see. When you deploy your machines to the fields, you train people to work them on the actual sites?
Yes, that's very important. We saw in some cases operator who has no skill and was not very efficient, and we have to train them to drive, to be efficient. The machine must be efficient. If the machine don't do the job in a good way, it costs too much and has not enough results. That's very, very important. The training is very important. Just for the story, when we sell a machine, we give 1 month of training with each machine for free because we think that's a very important point. The other point is for the maintenance of the machine. Such a machine is working in some countries at 50 degree ambient temperature with the engine at full power each time, all the time. And if you don't do a good maintenance, your machine will break down very, very quickly. Even if it's a strong machine, without maintenance, it's catastrophic. And the training is also very oriented to the maintenance of the machine.
You currently have a mission in Chad. Can you tell us a little bit about this mission?
Yes, that's a a special operation for us, because that's our first own operation. That means we were mandated by the DDC, by the Foreign Affairs of Swiss Foreign Affairs, for this operation, and we have our own deminers on this operation. And the machine is also a bit different to the other, because this machine is the first one which uses a GPS localization system. We try to improve our machine all the time to improve them. But making technology is not so simple in that way, because we have to prove the new technology is efficient, and the miner wants to see before selling something. And the fact that is our own operation help us to use this new technology, and also to show how efficient it is.
How much area do you demine typically in one mission?
Oh, it depends of the field. For example, you can very difficult fields, very hard soil, huge vegetation, you can do 300, 400 square meter per hour. And in some cases, when the soil is easier, you can go up to 1,000 to 1,200 square meter per day. Per hour, sorry.
Right. I see that you have two different digging systems here. Can you explain a little bit the two systems and what their differences are?
Mm-hmm. The first one was a bit more historical system, but still in use. That's a flail. The flail system is a rotative system. You have a drum, a kind of drum with chains and hammer at the end of each chain. You turn at 800 rotation per minute, and the chain with the hammer will dig the soil. You hit the soil and it digs it. The problem is the efficiency is not very high. That means, okay, this kind of hammer don't dig very well. They dig, but quite slowly.
Because your goal is actually to explode the mines.
Exactly. When we dig the soil, we try to hit the mine and to destroy them or to explode them, of course. And the system with the chain has a huge advantage on the other side. That means when you have an explosion, anti-tank mine explosion, for example, the chain lets the blast passing through, and you have almost no damage to the machine. And the other system is a kind of a tiller system, which is the same kind of digging system, but totally rigid system. The digging efficiency is a lot higher, but the sensitivity to explosion is also higher. That means sometimes you have some pieces which are bent or like that. You have more damage in case of anti-tank with this kind of system. That's a kind of compromise.
It's a compromise.
It's a kind of compromise between efficiency and security.
I see. So the anti-tank mines are typically, how much TNT is in an anti-tank mine?
You can go up to 8 kilograms of TNT, but sometimes you have more, 2 to 3 anti-tank mines stake. That's very dangerous. But the machine we built is made especially for anti-personnel mine, but you must have a machine which resists in case of anti-tank. If you know you have an anti-tank minefield, you don't send this machine. It's too small. It's not made for. But in case of anti-tank, anti-personnel minefield, you can have sometimes an anti-tank in the middle.
Yeah, as we saw in your commercial movie before, it's very impressive. You let your machine in a test trial run. Your machine runs over an 8 kilogram TNT mine. The mine explodes, and it's a huge explosion. You only see smoke for about 10 meters high, and the machine afterwards is completely undamaged. How is that technically possible? How do you build a machine which resists such an anti-tank explosion?
You have some damage, but small damage, and you accept this damage because you can repair them quite quickly. And how to treat such result? the main point is you know where the mine will explode. It means it will explode under the tool, in front of the machine. That means everything is made to anticipate the blast, shrapnel of at this precise point, and it helps a lot. For example, a tank, military tank, will have more damage in case of anti-tank, because you don't know exactly where the mine will explode. It explodes under the tank, and that's very difficult to protect a machine when it explodes under it. In our case, when it explodes in front of the machine, it's easier to let the blast passing through, and to manage the blast is easier in this case. That's the trick.
Yeah, I see. A little bit more into the technical details. So even though your machine is teleoperated, you do have a sort of a navigation system on it. Can you maybe describe this a little bit to us?
That's quite new. We use a real-time kinematic GPS system, because you need a precision of some centimeters, 1-2 centimeters of precision of localization. A car GPS, for example, is 5 to 10 meter precision. In case of demining, when you make a line, when you demine an area, you make some lines, and you have to pass line after line, and you cannot let an area without being flailed or digged by the machine in between. You must be very precise and ensure overlapping of the lines and so on. And the GPS we developed and put on the machine ensure it. The main problem with a machine when you don't have a GPS, when you dig, for example, in Sudan, where the soil is very wet and dry, you have a lot of dust. And when the digging tool hits the soil, you don't see the machine anymore. You just have a cloud of dust. And driving the machine precisely in this condition is impossible. And the GPS gives you in real time the position of the machine. You can ensure overlap, minimum overlap, ensuring a higher efficiency of your operation, and so on. That's a very useful new tool.
What is the, the security percentage that you guarantee after demining a field? Well, what percentage would you say you have demined a field?
When a machine is passing, you have a clearing efficiency of 95% to 99%. We cannot make a lot better than 99%, and that means if you don't just pass with a machine, you cannot give the field to a farmer, for example. You must have a second check made by human deminers, manual deminers after the machine. But this control is a lot easier than if the machine would not pass. That means it helps a lot, but you need a second quality control after the machine.
And after the second control, you have 100% safe field.
Yes, if you did the work in the condition of the standard operation procedure, yes.
Your machine actually gives feedback back to the control unit. You can see afterwards when you load the map of the demining, you can see the areas, the colors of where the machine covered the field and how deep it was able to cover the field in certain areas. You use that to perform your quality checks after the demining?
Yes, we try to encourage using this quality check. It's not the case, nor actually in the field. And no machine uses this kind of quality insurance. But we think it's very important to have this kind of reporting, and it ensures the driver, the operator, did the work in good conditions. If you have not this quality control, the operator can do everything. You cannot check all the part of the work, and with this kind of tracking system, you ensure all the work was done in the good quality, in the good condition, at the rated conditions. Yes.
So now I'm soon wrapping up the interview. A couple of questions into the future. Do you have goals of where you want this to go? Do you have a third system in development, or are you more focusing towards increasing the quality of what you already have?
We have now to ensure the quality of the machine. That's a very important point for us. In the field, when you have a breakdown, it's very difficult to repair. You spend a lot of time if it appears. That means it's very important. But of course, we develop in parallel all the time and to improve. My crazy dream is to have another totally automatic system, a real robot in the field. We work in Switzerland, where we build the machine. We are in the machine tool area, and it's normal in the factory of our area to work 24 a day. That means because investment of the factory is huge, and they want to use the maximum potential of their machine. But in humanitarian demining, it's not the case. Some machine works 8 hours a day, 5 hours a day. And we can do a lot better if we could make it automatic, working automatically, just filling the fuel sometimes. It could decrease a lot the cost of the square meter. That's a dream. It's, for the moment, it's totally crazy, but that's my dream.
Okay, so on this note, I think we would then conclude the interview and finalize by listening to the actual digger. So maybe if you could turn on the machine, we can give our listeners a bit of an idea of what this actually would sound like. Okay, so thank you so much, Frederick, for this interview. It was a pleasure.
Thank you to you. Thank you very much.
Harris Corporation is an international communications and information technology company serving government and commercial markets in more than 150 countries. The company mainly provides communication support and information processing systems for a range of areas, from civilian air traffic control to military defense programs. Dr. Paul Boscher, Chief Robotics Engineer at Harris Corporation, spoke to Amanda about the company's involvement in the diffusion of improvised explosive devices.
Hi, Dr. Boscher, and welcome to Robots.
Thank you.
To start off with, why don't you tell us a little bit about what topics in robotics Harris researches on?
So we've actually been doing research in robotics for almost a couple of decades now. It's ranged from topics such as novel robotic mobility platforms, such as very small tracked vehicles, legged robots, artificial muscle snake-like robots. In the past few years, we've been focusing primarily on manipulation sorts of tasks, such as haptic teleoperation, multi-arm robotic collaboration, autonomous collision avoidance motions. And I would say as a general theme, we tend to focus on applications where we are providing remote, sort of telepresence of an operator operating in some sort of distant or harsh or otherwise inaccessible environment.
Right. So as part of these tasks, you also focus on the diffusion of improvised explosive devices, otherwise known as IEDs. Could you maybe walk us through such a typical IED diffusion mission?
Sure, yeah. So the IED defeat is something that we've been focusing on more recently. Obviously, it's a very relevant topic. Actually, the IEDs are the number one killer of troops in the Middle East right now. And so what we've done is we're trying to take haptic teleoperation and some eventual autonomy, incorporate that into the robots that are being fielded right now. And so the challenge that is being faced, and this is not just a military problem also, this is something that's becoming, unfortunately, an increasing problem for countries domestically, where we're seeing domestic terrorism start to adopt some of the tactics that we've seen in the war zones. So the challenge is sort of twofold. One is the IED detection problem, which is not a problem that we focus on solving, but it's a very challenging issue, is locating, you know, knowing that there is a device that is a threat out there. But once that's been identified, they call in the explosive ordnance disposal teams, the EOD teams. And typically, they're going to bring in a robot. The Kinetic Talon, the iRobot Packbot are the most commonly used ones, although sometimes the larger Remotec platforms are used. They'll drive in, inspect the device. Depending on the type of device, they'll decide whether it can be defeated on site, especially if it's in a sensitive location, such as, you know, if you were in a near a school or a mall or a road that you don't want to have damaged. They'd like to be able to defeat those devices on site. The challenge that they have is that the robots they've got in the field right now really lack the manipulation capability in order to do these tasks remotely. And so, unfortunately, a lot of the times you end up having a soldier or a police officer having to put on a bomb suit and going down and manually disarming these devices. And so what we're trying to do is remove the human having to walk up to the bomb in order to defeat it. Keep them safe, keep them at a good standoff distance.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned quite a couple of challenges in this whole mission. What particularly makes this task so complex?
Well, I would say one of the biggest challenges is you don't necessarily know what you're going to be facing. And so the EOD technicians not only have to be skilled in identifying a lot of explosive devices, but you need ultimately a robotic system, a robotic solution that's highly capable, that's able to tackle a wide variety of sort of tasks. So it's very difficult to try to develop any sort of specialized solutions, because ultimately the rate at which these different sort of explosive devices are being developed, you know, new techniques are being developed by, you know, our enemies all the time. Mm-hmm. And so from a technical standpoint, it's very difficult to make something that is able to handle the rigors of a military or a police sort of environment. So it has to be very rugged, survivable, cheap, but also precise and capable enough. And then another one of the major challenges is because it's such a dangerous scenario, you want to make sure that the operators who are controlling your robot are able to be at a significant standoff distance to be safe. So you have to 100% rely on camera views or sensors to provide your contextual information to the operator. You have to provide a intuitive manner of controlling the robot arm so that they can perform some somewhat complex tasks. And you also need to be able to have the arm be very reliable, because some of these explosive devices can be actually set off by being, you know, bumped. And so the challenge of doing essentially almost surgical level manipulation with militarized hardware in what's ultimately a hostile environment makes for a very, you know, difficult intersection of challenges.
Right. So you touched on a very interesting subject just before. So the evolution of bomb making skills is very fast. So research has shown that this can take just a matter of weeks for new bombs to come out there. So are your developments, do you try to be general to all ID types, or do you rather concentrate on a certain denominator set of types?
It's a good question. It's next to impossible to create one solution that will solve every single problem. So certainly we're aiming to be as general as possible. We try to avoid anything that is specific to any particular sort of IED. The technologies that we're developing is a retrofit system that can be put on these vehicles that gives a highly dexterous manipulator that's got force sensing at the end of the arm, and then an intuitive haptic controller to provide motion control of the arm that's very easy to perform. You can do some very complex tasks, and then it provides force feedback to the operator so that they can feel what the end of the arm is feeling when you contact things. So our perspective on this is that by providing something that provides human-like arm dexterity, human-like or better precision, and human-like range of motion, we sort of capture a lot of what gives us as people an ability to tackle a wide variety of problems by hand. Obviously, it's not going to be a general solution because there are going to be times where, you know, you might have something covering up your IED that's too heavy for your robot arm to lift, or it's something that's going to, you know, require you know, a particular tool that your robot can't hold. There's always going to be exceptions, but from our experience with the EOD operators, they're very industrious guys. They come up with some very, very clever solutions on the fly. So if you can get them a tool that's capable of solving 90% of their problems, they're pretty good about filling in those remaining gaps on the off chance that your robot's not capable of solving the problem on its own.
Mm-hmm. So more specifically, apart from saving a human's life, maybe, how does your haptic interface approach alleviate the shortcomings of common non-robotic approaches?
Well, the biggest problem with non-robotic approaches, as you mentioned, is the safety. It's getting the person up there. Other sorts of non-robotic approaches that are being used, and I'm going to use non-robotic a little bit loosely here because they will oftentimes use a robot to position some of these devices. Some of them are such as disruptors, where they'll fire a water charge at the device to blow it apart and render it safe. Other times what they will do is use the robot to bring down a block of C4 explosive, set it on the device or near the device, and set it off. Any of those tasks where you are not putting a person downrange and the person is actually doing the defusing. Any other approaches have up until now centered on destroying the device and destroying the device in a way that doesn't set the device off, that essentially separates the triggering mechanism from the explosive itself. The problem with this sort of an approach is that while you may have defeated this one device, you do have a risk of it going off when you use these sort of charges to try to, you know, explosively separate the charge from the triggering mechanism. So you're also generally doing some damage to the surrounding environment. So let's say that you have a domestic situation, you might have a bomb in a school or a mall or someplace. You'd rather not have to drop a block of C4 onto something and blow it up in order to defeat the IED. You're going to put a hole in something you'd rather not put a hole in. And the second problem with that is you're not just trying to defeat this one explosive device. You're trying to figure out who's making these explosive devices, how they're making them, where they're getting their materials. And the way that you defeat that is by essentially, you know, once you've defeated the device by removing the triggering mechanism or somehow rendering it safe, essentially examining it for forensic data, pulling fingerprints, hair samples, if you can get SIM cards out of cell phones. This is the sort of data that you can collect and then use to try to defeat the bomb-making network that's actually behind this individual bomb. So any non-robotic approaches that are used right now tend to destroy some of that evidence in the process. And so being able to get in there and robotically render it safe through a manipulation system, you sort of get the best of both worlds where you're getting the human ability to render it safe without losing forensic information, but at the same time keeping the human at a safe standoff distance.
Very interesting. So given this really deep complexity of your mission and the intertwining of all these constraints from these different aspects of the mission that you're trying to solve, how do you go about deciding what aspects you want to push in developing your haptic interface? Do you value precision more than robustness or speed more than cost? Do you give any more importance to one of these than to the other?
Yeah, anytime you're designing a system like this, there's always trade-offs between these, you know, the relative aspects of it. And, it's give and take. You can't have everything you'd like. Of that list that you gave, that's actually a fairly good list. So precision, robustness, speed, and cost are all some of your top requirements or specifications. I would say that the most important one is probably robustness, followed by cost, because no matter how capable the system, if it breaks, the soldiers aren't going to use it. It's not only going to not work for them, but one or two bad experiences with it is all that it takes to turn them off to the technology entirely, and you've done more harm than good there. So having something that'll do its job but take a beating is really important for these guys, because they really put stuff through its paces. Cost is obviously significant, because if they can't afford it, it's not going to get in their hands to begin with. Between precision and speed, I would say precision is the more important requirement. While speed is a consideration for them, they want to be able to get in and get out relatively quickly, because it might be a hostile or dangerous environment. They're generally very careful when they're actually defusing the device. So having an arm or a controller that can move particularly fast is not really going to help them nearly as much as something that can go in there and be extremely precise and very capable, even if it happens to be slow.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so your system is actually composed of two main components, the operator control unit and the unmanned ground vehicle. Could you maybe describe these two components?
Sure. So the unmanned ground vehicle is I'm going to go with their most typical ones, because there's actually quite a wide variety of what's used. But the most commonly used, the most widely operated are the Kinetic Talon and the iRobot PackBot. Both of these are tracked vehicles. The Talon has just the two tracks, and it's approximately 3 feet long, maybe about a foot tall, has a arm with two joints in the base configuration, although they do have upgradable heavy lift arms that have 3 and 4 degrees of freedom to them, with a couple of cameras on the arm and a camera at sort of the back of the vehicle up on a mast that looks down at the scene in front of the robot. The PackBot is a similar vehicle, slightly smaller. It's got a couple of flippers on the front of the vehicle that are also tracked that can be raised and lowered. It's helpful for getting upstairs or up a curb in a street. Has a higher degree of freedom arm with a bit more reach. It's about a 5 degree of freedom arm, but it's a much lower weight capacity arm. Also has a set of cameras on it. The biggest drawback for both of these systems is that they're currently being controlled using joint-by-joint control. So they are either using a Xbox sort of controller to control them, or essentially a collection of switches inside of a briefcase-style box that they open up in order to control the joints. So it's very difficult to get coordinated motion of the joints of the arm to do any precise motion. It's one joint at a time. The OCU for those standard vehicles either looks, like I said, like a briefcase with switches in it and a screen, or a laptop, like a ruggedized laptop-style device. What we are developing is something that's able to be retrofitted onto those. And the reason for that is, rather than developing a completely new system from the ground up, we're basically looking at the fact that there are already thousands of these vehicles out there. In a mobility sense, they're very capable. It's the manipulation portion of it that's really the shortcoming, in our opinion. And so what we've developed is a new manipulator that will bolt onto either one of those vehicles. It's got its own power supply with a militarized battery in there, radio, all the control electronics, so that you can essentially remove the manipulator arms that are standard to the vehicles and pop this on. And then on the control side, we've developed a haptic device, again, similar in size to the existing controllers that they have, It's approximately 18 inches across and maybe 14 inches deep. Sits either on your lap or like on a tabletop with a handle that the person holds that's kind of like a pistol grip. The mechanism attached to that pistol grip is a delta mechanism, and it's actuated, so it provides the ability to exert forces on the person's hand. So as they move their hand around holding on to this pistol grip, if they hold down a button to enable control of the arm, as they move their hand around, their motion is measured, commanded to the robot. The robot will mimic their motion so that the tool moves exactly the way their hand moves spatially. And then if there's any contact force of the robot contacting the environment, that force is sent back to the controller, which the motors in the base of it will exert a force through that mechanism back onto the person's hand. And so it's meant to work essentially side by side with the existing controllers for the vehicles themselves. So you'll use the existing vehicle OCU in order to drive the vehicle around. You can use the cameras there, and then use our manipulation controller in order to do the precise manipulation tasks with the new retrofitted arm.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that looking way down the road, it would be interesting later on to consider the autonomous execution of this task?
Absolutely. It's actually on our research roadmap. That's something that we've begun working on already now. We have a couple of programs that we've started up. One of them is actually for some underwater manipulation with an autonomous underwater vehicle, but we're also looking at autonomous behaviors for the unmanned ground vehicles that are for this bomb disposal application. I think in the context of the explosive ordnance disposal, the most important thing for autonomy is for it to be something that, for lack of a better word, is kind of manageable. The soldiers don't like the idea of a robot terminator. They don't want a robot that's out there with its own brain running wild and they don't know what it's going to do. I think the most useful autonomy for a soldier or a bomb tech as part of a police force is, I would say, autonomy in chunks. So, for example, I might tell my robot, this is the location I want you to drive to. Go ahead and get yourself there, and have the autonomy kick in, automatically drive itself to a location, await further instructions. Or, for example, with manipulation, you might click on an object on a user interface on your screen and say, this is an object of interest to me, I'd like you to go scan this object, or I'd like you to go pick this object up. Autonomy that will reduce the workload of the operator. I think if you give them that, that's something that they'll embrace as something that will remove work from them without feeling like the robot is doing the decision making on how a problem should be solved or how the mission should proceed. The soldier ultimately wants to control that. Down the road, if those levels of autonomy are successful, I think it's something that as they become more comfortable with it, higher and more complete levels of autonomy start to become possible. But I think an incremental step towards that is absolutely possible, and I think is very realistic to start seeing rolled into these systems in the not-too-distant future.
Right. So to conclude this interview, what is your ultimate goal with your research?
Well, as I mentioned, we're getting more into autonomy now. I think the teleoperation combined with autonomy is, I think, what we'd really like to see, where you've got a system that's capable of doing things on its own. For example, the unmanned ground vehicle, where it's actually able to go and manipulate objects and perform tasks, objects it's never seen before, to be able to identify them, but then to seamlessly transition into a user taking control of it and having intuitive control interfaces so that they're able to go and do something extraordinarily precise, but then be able to turn around and tell the robot, I've done what I want to do, you know, go ahead and take care of the rest. So that sort of bigger picture idea leads to some of the specific technologies that we're working on for autonomous navigation, autonomous object recognition, and object grasping, all of these in unstructured environments. So ultimately, I think that those are the sort of capabilities that start to open up just extraordinary possible applications for robotics, both in the military environment that I've just described, but also ultimately in people's everyday lives.
Dr. Boscia, thank you very much for joining us on Robots.
Hey, thank you for having me.
And that's it for today. If you've been inspired to find out more, visit our website at www.robotspodcast.com. for information on this week's guests and all our past episodes. We'll be back in 2 weeks' time. Until then, goodbye. DMind with Robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics.